dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has brought uncommon intelligence to a lifetime of service in that war in several different capacities, notably as a member of the United States Army, as well as a civilian employee of the Defense Department, a senior executive service member there, a man who managed programs, including classified ones, for Special Operations Command, and who these days is a successful business entrepreneur and very active in the public policy debate, I'm happy to say. His name is Rich Higgins. He is the CEO of Higgins Technology Group and a vice president for intelligence and national security at RED, Inc. He formerly served as the director of strategic planning for the Trump National Security Council, and particularly important for our conversation today, which I'm ecstatic to say is going to go for a full hour. He is the author of The Memo, 20 Years Inside the Deep State, Fighting for America First. Rich Higgins, it's a delight to have you with us, and thank you for giving us so generously of your time at this very important moment. So, Rich, The Memo, the title of your book, refers to actually a memo, a specific memo that you wrote to President Trump during your period on the National Security Council staff. Tell us about that memo. It's become quite famous, I think it's fair to say. But before we get into that and what came of it, as far as you were personally concerned, just give us sort of the thrust of what it was about and why it generated such intense interest.
Well, I, in a nutshell, back in the very early early months, days of the administration, we saw a concerted campaign being conducted targeting the newly elected president, President Trump, and it was within Earth's earliest transition. We saw some things that just didn't feel right. So I had been with the campaign as one of the president's counterterrorism advisors. I was collegial with and friendly with Bannon and Flynn and all the other household names. And all of us, I think, were ecstatic, on November 8th, as so many of us were. And, we took sort of the, hey, we're going to go through a normal transition. And it was quickly apparent that wasn't happening. And so, through various ups and downs throughout the transition and then early into the administration, when we saw things like the president's phone calls being leaked, became clear that something was amiss. And, after having taken the position inside the National Security Council, I set about trying to ferret out what is going on here. And you have to put yourself back in time. This is before we knew about the Page and Strzok texts. This is before we knew about Crossfire Hurricane. This is before we knew about all of the things that have since come to light. And I think what I saw was, and my particular largest concern was, there were several holdovers from from particularly the intelligence community, but other elements of the government that were not on board with President Trump's agenda. And so, I set about writing this memo to warn people around the president that what he was experiencing was not normal, and that the drivers behind, what he was experiencing were myriad. There wasn't a single individual or actor that was behind this. There were multiple agencies, organizations, and people. However, at the time, I was unable to say specifically that it's this individual or it's that individual. That information wouldn't come until later.
As you found yourself in this situation, Rich, you were not only confronting people who were holdovers, as you say, from the Obama-Biden administration, you were dealing with detailees from the intelligence agencies and other agencies who populate the National Security Council. You also were presumably interacting with individuals who had been brought in by Reince Priebus, who was the first chief of staff to the president, and Steve Bannon, you mentioned, and friend of both of ours, who was at the time the chief strategist for the White House, described the relinquishing of control to Reince Priebus shortly after the election as the original sin of the Trump administration. So talk a little bit about those personnel elements, because as my old boss Ronald Reagan used to say, people are policy.
Absolutely, their policy. And I think, look, the president himself is a businessman. I think, he was elected. He had no context. None of us did. I mean, the thing that's tough for people to understand is that nobody's experienced the transition like this before, right? I mean, maybe Abraham Lincoln in 1860, where he's sneaking into Washington and on his train, but we've never seen anything like this. And so one of the early mistakes, and is the president's a quick learner. The challenge with the personnel system is, as Frank, the government personnel is an unwieldy instrument, to say the least. And so once you start in the wrong direction, it's very difficult to get it back on track. And the president has spent the better part of the past year and a half, I think, doing that. After Mueller was finally shut down, he is a quick learner. But back in early 2017, late 2016, after the election victory, he made this sort of Faustian bargain with the RNC, where they would help him populate his administration, stand up government, if you will. And in so doing, he largely relinquished control of his own administration, i.e. the MAGA agenda, and turned it over to the RNC, who, was vehemently opposed to him throughout most of the election cycle.
And I guess part of this is just in fairness, as you say, it's not only that he was an outsider and that he was coming at it with, a non-professional politician's perspective on things, but he also didn't have a sizable entourage. I mean, the number of people like yourself who were actually involved in that campaign, the MAGA agenda, as you say, the Make America Great Again, adherents and supporters, you could count on a couple of hands, it seems to me. And so he really had no choice but to sort of contract this out. But tragically, the people to whom he contracted it were, as you say, people who had been very much opposed to him and continue to be so, I think it's fair to say, subsequent to his hiring them, no?
Absolutely. And I think, these decisions have reverbed down through the years, right? And the challenge is these institutions have their own political orbits, right, and their own political gravity. So, and the president, I think the president rightly decided to execute a form of cabinet governance as opposed to just driving policy from the National Security Council. The problem is that he ran afoul in his personnel choices, and so that became more unwieldy than it perhaps should have been. I think, when he wins re-election here, he's gonna have to do, at some point you have to shut down the computer and reboot it. And I'm really hoping that that's what November 4th is this year.
We'll pick up on the other side with Rich Higgins, the author of the memo, 20 Years Inside the Deep State, Fighting for America First, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting this full hour, I'm thrilled to say, with Rich Higgins, a former member of the Trump National Security Council. We're talking about some of his experiences, both inside the government during that stint, but before that, and certainly what he has been seeing since, much of which is captured in an important new book entitled The Memo, 20 Years Inside the Deep State, Fighting for America First. Rich, I wanted to just ask you to sort of come back to the issue of the memo itself, and specifically what you were recommending, having diagnosed, I think, with considerable prescience, borne out by what we've learned since from the Mueller investigation, from the various inspector general investigations, from such congressional investigations as we've had, and so on, the truth of the hostile personnel inside the Trump administration who were doing everything they could to sabotage this president and, if possible, drive him from office. What did you in this memo to the president recommend be done about that harsh reality?
Well, the memo that was available publicly, and you know, had been leaked subsequent to my departure from the White House, didn't specify our table of recommendations, which I always took as a good sign, actually, that maybe somebody was going to do something, although that never materialized. However, you know, what we had originally planned was to put together what we would call a campaign plan, and to fight against what, you know, what was clearly to me and to others an organized operational effort to remove the president, first through delegitimizing him, and then ultimately what we saw, you know, with the Mueller stand-up attempt to remove him, all of this on a, you know, on a bench of spying and illegal, you know, covert actions that were being conducted against them, to include leaking his telephonic transcripts with foreign leaders. I mean, it's still even to this day surreal to think about. I mean, this is the type of thing that our intelligence community would be doing to Saddam Hussein, right? I mean, we still haven't really fully come to grips with how dangerous this is to our country.
And in no small measure, at the hands of people bringing those same skills to bear against our own government, right?
Right. I mean, that's the thing that's just shocking about all of this, whether it's the disinformation campaigns we see going on today over the Biden laptop, or the abuse of the FISA Surveillance Act, et cetera, or the, you know, leaking of the transcripts, or the personnel, you know, burrowing into an administration to sabotage it. I mean, these are the types of things you see in third world dictatorships, right? This is just unbelievable to me that it's happening here. And so that, you know, what we had tried with this memo was to get the president and those around him to recognize that you're in a fight. This isn't just normal political comeuppance and gamesmanship, that you have to, you know, and in the military term is the crisis. You need a crisis action cell to deal with this. You have to combat them on these various things that they're doing. We need to be, you know, working against. We need to be hunting down leakers. We need to be finding out who's doing the spying. If we need to, we need to start pulling security clearances. All of the things that one could imagine need to be done in such a situation as this.
Rich, it's interesting just to go back in time for a moment to see that those were presumably some of the things that Michael Flynn would also have been pursuing had he not been essentially taken out and shot, figuratively, fortunately, by the deep state operating against him, this anti-Trump conspiracy that you were warning about in this memo, which was written several months after his removal from the role of National Security Advisor. Let's introduce another player in this drama, the man who succeeded him, H.R. McMaster, Lieutenant General, United States Army, now retired, I believe. What have you to say about both what his leadership was like during the post-Flynn period while you were at the NSC, as well as how he acted when this memo was apparently turned over by the president to him for action?
Well, as far as the memo being turned over to McMaster, I can tell you that my feet didn't hit the ground. He very rapidly had me removed from the premises as quickly as he could. He had to shop it around a little bit. Apparently some of the lawyers disagreed with his action, but in a matter of a couple of days, I was gone.
This is an important part of the story. Rich Higgins, you write a memo that has been vindicated, I think it's fair to say, by historical events. The president reads it, apparently takes it to heart, turns it over to his national security advisor, presumably for action in the sense of do what this is recommending be done. And you're telling me that the first thing that he does is cashier the author of the memo?
It's exactly what he did. Now, you know, so people that are in your listening audience understand, I had already assessed McMaster as hostile, which is one of the reasons, I'm a military guy. I know the chain of command. One of the reasons I brought the memo to the attention of the folks that had been on the campaign with us is because I did not trust the guys in the chain of command at the National Security Council, whether that be McMaster or Rick Waddell or any of those guys. And so the memo went back channel through some of the Trump's more trusted, closer advisors that had been with him from the campaign. And you know, my take on it is, and again, this is all secondhand, and nobody's ever confirmed this for me, but the president had the memo in his reading file, and he read it a few weeks after he'd originally received it. He liked it, and he came back, and it was marked up, and he handed it over to Priebus and McMaster. And all the president knew, because I hadn't originally signed the memo, I had just passed it around conceptually to these guys. And all he knew was somebody at the NSC had written it. So McMaster made it his mission in life to find and eliminate me. You know, and I think his point, and even today, is no, you know, he calls it the Bannon, what do you call it, the Bannon trope memo or something like that, right? I mean, there was so much animosity between the nationalist populist group in the White House and then these globalists like McMaster, and that was so much of it. Yeah, you know, the other things about McMaster, to go back to the original question, is number one, I think with McMaster, he inversed the roles of the National Security Advisor insofar as I think he really felt it was his job to tell the president what the institutions would let him do or allow him to do. And he didn't understand that his role was to translate the commander's intent or the commander-in-chief's intent to the institutions. And the second thing, and I don't know if your listening audience is aware of this, but the second thing is through General Petraeus, General McMaster was communicating pretty regularly with Soros, and to the point where his executive assistant left over concerns about these communications.
When you say communicating, let me just put a fine point on this. What was he communicating? Was he communicating internal information about what the president was doing, what decisions were being made, and sensitive policy deliberations?
Yes.
To George Soros. Now, just say a word about who George Soros is. I think our audience is fairly familiar with him, but what's your assessment of the man and the role that he would be playing with such information?
Oh, so, I mean, George Soros is, yeah, I mean, he is more than anything else, he's a funding manipulator, right? I mean, he's not a pure ideologue, but he despises Trump's nationalist agenda and has set out to sabotage it from day one.
Yeah, I would suggest he detests this country, for that matter, and certainly the Constitutional Republic. He's about a fundamental transformation, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and he's I guess the simplest way to describe it is, if I were to say that, you know, if I were to describe President Trump's arch nemesis, it's George Soros. And so you have McMaster communicating with him via General Petraeus, the executive assistant. This is a senior captain, 06, literally resigning his job at the White House and returning to the fleet to get away from him.
Because he saw something that was compromising, not just the presidency, presumably, but also national security.
Correct. He wanted nothing to do with it, is exactly what he told me about it. So I think that between that and what we saw going on, where the young intel analyst, Ezra Cohen, who had discovered the spying campaign, particularly Samantha Power's abuse of the FISA in her role at the United Nations as the ambassador up there. She had been unmasking, I think it was 300 or 400 people. You saw McMaster moving forcefully to try and get rid of Ezra Cohen as well. It was quite clear to me that McMaster was on the other side of whatever it was we were experiencing.
This is so critical, Rich. And again, for this audience, I think they're pretty sophisticated about these sorts of machinations. But I think the vast majority of the American people would have no idea that the president was essentially surrounded, even at the most senior levels of his personal staff inside the White House, by people who were disloyal to him, who did not consider it their job to support him, but rather to control him so as to ensure that the diktat of the bureaucracy or cabinet or deep state, whatever term you wish to use, was going to be essentially what would guide the policies of the administration. And to the extent that you and others like you who are pointing out that this is not actually the way this system is designed to work, that the president got elected. It is his call on the policies. It is for the bureaucracy to implement those policies and for those who are his subordinates to be loyal to him in ensuring they do that. I mean, this is mind-boggling. And this is what makes, I think, your new book, The Memo, 20 years inside the deep state fighting for America first, both such compelling reading, Rich, but also such necessary reading, especially as we head into this election and the opportunity that it may afford us for a reboot. Rich, we're going to take a short break. We will be right back with more about what happened next to the administration, to Rich personally, and to the cause of freedom. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting, it's a delight to say, for a full hour about one of the most important books that's been written, certainly in the past decade, in my estimation. It's entitled The Memo. It's 20 years inside the deep state fighting for America first. Its author is a man who did just that for a time inside the Trump administration and before that inside the Pentagon, the United States Army, and since in the private sector in a variety of different capacities, including his present one as CEO of Higgins Technology Group, LLC. His name is Rich Higgins. I'll say right up front, he's a friend as well as a very valued colleague of mine, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk about his new book and its recommendations. Rich, I want to talk about the period since you were essentially frog-marched out of the White House complex by H.R. McMaster for the crime of having told the president the truth about what was going on inside his administration, a truth that's been borne out now by subsequent events, for sure. Tell us a little bit about what has transpired in the subsequent 3.5 years or so of this administration that has unfortunately, as I say, not only vindicated your warnings, but also hamstrung this president and his agenda. It's amazing to me how much he's gotten accomplished despite it all, but talk about that MAGA agenda and how it has suffered as a result of all of these shenanigans.
Well, I think the president is just, I mean, he's just he's a force of nature. I've never seen anything like it. And, you know, this isn't just blowing smoke. I mean, if you just think, I mean, he was subverted as a candidate, subverted as the president. They tried to remove him through a coup. They've shifted gears post the first attempt to remove him with Mueller into a second attempt with post-constitutional impeachment. Don't even know if sham impeachment, just a joke. And now we see them moving into overt insurrection and violence on the streets, in which we've seen over the past 5-6 months. It's truly surreal. And what is this real? What is this fight? What is MAGA? In my mind, it's really very simple. The left, meaning the Marxist, socialist, globalist left, is terrified of an American nationalist movement, the national populist, or just American nationalist movement in America that will stand up for itself. And so, they have set about doing everything they can to vilify, dirty up, smear, everything they can about the MAGA movement of President Trump as sort of, the iconic representative thereof. And the reason they hate him is really very simple. He is a production capitalist who wants to see America have a strong middle class. And so, and within the past 15, 16 months, we've seen, and it's amazing because they tell us they're going to do it. We saw the New York Times push a piece on the utilization of Cloward Pivens to collapse a country. Then we see in May of 2019, I think these both happened within about a week of one another, the New York Times article. Then May of 2019, China declares people's war. And then we see the impeachment keeps everybody occupied. Next thing you know, we have COVID-19, and we see what's happened since then. The state is just absolutely run amok. And it's just we're in a new form of war we don't fully comprehend yet. right? We're kind of getting our heads around it, but it's a slow learning curve. And I think what we're going to see here on November 4th is we're going to go into the next phase, which will be the color revolution phase.
I want to drill down on all of that, Rich, but just to go back to something you said earlier, it seems to me that at least as arguable a proposition is that it's not just that these folks were, you know, hostile to the MAGA, you know, alternative to their brand. It's that they saw it as a mortal threat to the progress that they had been making. Essentially, well, Barack Obama promised it, didn't he, on the eve of his election in 2008, the fundamental transformation of America. And whether it's hollowing out the economy and, you know, transferring much of it to China, or whether it was, you know, instituting increasingly, you know, restrictions on our freedoms, much of which, as you say, has been, you know, implemented under the guise of responding to the COVID crisis. But that's what this is really about, it seems to me, is which direction is this country going to take? And it may be our last chance to keep it pretty much on the path of the constitutional republic as the founders envisioned it, more or less, and as I think the vast majority of Americans want it to remain. Your thoughts?
I think that in 1860, Lincoln was elected to stop the expansion of slavery, and the South reacted to that, right? And I think that Donald Trump was elected to stop the expansion of the socialist communist project, and we see them responding to that. I think, you know, when you think of Obama's policies, I think of him, he became more open about it during his second term. He would use the term, I think it was managed decline. And we always just kind of sat back, but the thing that's so frightening about the current situation is that we have China, you know, Turkey with their Islamist allies, elements of the EU and some of the central bankers in Europe that have invested heavily in China, all of them on the side of the globalist communist forces that are active here in the United States, that don't necessarily, as long as their outcome is a weaker United States, they don't necessarily care about the war per se. They just want anything that can happen to make us weaker is seen in their mind as beneficial to their OBOR project, the One Belt, One Road project, right? And that One Belt, One Road project is going to, it really should be the centerpiece on which we evaluate most of what's happening in the geopolitical space right now, because it is nothing less than the unification of the Eurasian landmass. I mean, it's a massive project in the scale of human history.
And ominous, if it is in the service, particularly of the Chinese Communist Party and its ambitions to dominate the entire world. This is a subject to which I want to return. But Rich, before we do, just you laid out very nicely sort of the trajectory of what happened to this president after your memo and right up to the present moment. And you described it as Cloward Pivens, which is a brand that might be worth taking a moment to describe as well, but sort of a revolutionary playbook from the hard left, two individuals, Cloward and Pivens. The People's War declared against us by the leader of the Chinese Communist Party, the impeachment that was manufactured, as you've talked about that a bit, but then, you know, COVID-19 as a kind of a control mechanism used to advance this takeover, or at least to assure the victory of an alternative to Donald Trump, who was very much aligned with these hard leftists and their, you know, Muslim Brotherhood allies and globalists and so on. So just take another couple of minutes, if you would, to elaborate on the key elements of that and how you see those as sort of essentially part of a grand enterprise brought to us by enemies of our republic.
I think the simplest way to describe it, as I see it, is it's a convergence of multiple threat streams, right? And the convergence of those threat streams has, you know, ideological and financial underpinnings. We already discussed the OBOR project and how that's driven some of the international money, the corporatists and others into supporting this agenda. And now we see what I'll, you know, the unspoken maybe not alliance, but allegiance that's emerging in the Middle East between Turkey and China. Turkey is kind of the vanguard, if you will, of the Islamist movement worldwide, and China is the vanguard of the communist movement worldwide. These two forces, basically coalesce in terms of their revolutionary ideology is profoundly anti-American. And we've seen, that they're throwing everything short of war at us, right?
Well, in fact, arguably, they're throwing war at us as well, just of a sort of non-kinetic kind at the moment.
Correct. And that goes to the point I was trying to make, Frank, is that what we see as operations other than war, the Chinese just see in a continuum. Their Maoist influences show, in Mao's framework of warfare, this is war. Politics and war operate on a continuum in Mao's understanding of events. They're not interrelated. They are the same. And I think what you laid out, I think nicely, was kind of all the different systems they're deploying, Cloward Pivens being an economic and institutional systems attack, COVID-19 being a population and psychological warfare attack, riding on the backbone of a biochemical attack. All of these types of, I'll call them interoperable functions, are laid out very clearly in a book that the Chinese published more than 20 years ago called Unrestricted Warfare. And what you read about in page 144 to 148 of Unrestricted Warfare is what you see when you look out your window today. And they call it the quote-unquote combined method, where you attack on multiple different lines of effort so as to collapse your enemy's immune system, if you will. And that's what we see happening.
This is a fascinating point. And again, when we come back, Rich, I want to have you sort of talk through where we are right this minute, looking at this election, looking at what's coming next, and what we're going to have to do about it. But just to tie that up, what you've just said, I think this is so critically important. We're dealing with an axis, an alliance, whatever you want to call it, a consortium, that have similar end states in mind, not identical necessarily. They have their own visions of who's going to run things, but basically it's a world in which we are either gone or certainly submitting to them. And whether it's the Chinese communists or whether it's the Marxists more generally, or it's the Muslim Brotherhood, or it's the globalists, or it's the capitalists who are fellow travelers with them, they are our enemies, make no mistake about it, and they must be countered as such. And we'll talk with Rich Higgins, the author of the new book, The Memo, 20 Years Inside the Deep State, Fighting for America First, about how we do that right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're speaking with the author of The Memo, 20 Years Inside the Deep State, Fighting for America First. His name is Rich Higgins. This is the fourth installment of our hour-long conversation with him, for which, again, I am very grateful, Rich. You've really described, I think, incredibly powerfully, and it seems to me accurately, what we are up against as a people, as a nation, as a freedom-loving constitutional republic. Talk a little bit about what you see as in prospect now, in the middle of and subsequent to this election endgame. And, you've thrown in the term the color revolution. What is that? And to the extent that it's what's in prospect, talk us through it.
Well, I think where we are right now is the other side is the other side, meaning the left, is having a difficult time right now deciding which course of action they want to pursue. So they kind of chose the benign middle, thinking that my personal opinion is that they ran Joe Biden as almost a getaway car, right, for much of the illegal activity that went on in the prior administration as it pertained to spying, particularly on the campaign, Donald Trump, but others as well. And I think the frightening thing is that Kamala Harris is the, she is the actual candidate, right? I don't think Biden necessarily even will take office per se. Kamala Harris is tied up with the San Francisco network of hardcore Marxists. She's got good ties into Silicon Valley. It makes sense that they would want to put her in there because she will continue to take her taskings from the folks over in Calorama, being Obama and Val and that whole crowd. And so now what you see is this move to a color revolution model. And for those who aren't familiar with color revolutions, it's a NGO-based, intelligence community, media-based, operational design that seeks to remove with as little violence as possible foreign leaders in the furtherance of, you know, the sponsoring activities. Oftentimes, these tend to be affiliated with Soros and parts of our, the United States or Western intelligence organizations. Again, going back to, once again, we see our intelligence organizations being used here against the American people. Frightening. And what the hallmarks of a color revolution are really, I guess, there are three things. Number one is institutional hesitation. Right? So the organs of power that you'd think would respond to deal with whatever crisis comes don't. This is the FBI's non-response to Antifa. This is the FBI's trying to castigate every violent act in the country as white supremacists when we see Marxist anarchists burning down buildings in 128 cities across the country. The second piece is the media and social media, the control of the media and social media. And we see them, meaning particularly social media, really exercising that power in the past couple months, right? Now, they had been doing it for a number of years. Several of us were complaining, and it was largely ignored. Now, all of a sudden, they're shutting down the Trump campaign website. They're shutting down the New York Post. They're shutting down Charlie Kirk and other supporters of Trump, i.e. silencing the dissidents, silencing the MAGA people. And then the last piece is the international pressure that will be brought to bear. This will be the United Nations, European Union, foreign countries demanding that, in this scenario, Trump be removed, i.e., he didn't win the popular vote, the electoral college is in question, and we see now this, I'll call it crisis engineering, going on. So it's really, a color revolution is really a form of perception warfare. And the most, I think, clear illustration, if you want to say that was most, I guess the most well covered, was what happened in Egypt in Tahrir Square. That was kind of a classic color revolution design, where Mubarak was holding on to power. The referendum went the way we thought it would, but then it was delegitimized. And eventually it was really the United States and Barack Obama who pushed Mubarak out, said we wouldn't back him. The same type of scenario was, I think, what they're hoping to achieve here. And unfortunately, Justice Roberts yesterday, with his allowing Pennsylvania to extend their voting window, I think, by 72 or 96 hours, he may have pulled the safety on the grenade. That's exactly the type of thing that they need, especially in such an important state as Pennsylvania, where, the Democrat machine is there and completely, aligned with much of what the Marxists hope to achieve. And this is the thing I think that shocks me the most is my family up until probably 1980 had been, Democrats for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. When I go back and talk to my family now, they just say, where did all these Marxists come from? And I think that's the sense a lot of us have today is that, this isn't a political issue. This is a national security issue that one of our political parties has been infected with this profoundly anti-American ideology. And we're going to head into some choppy water here.
Let's just characterize the choppy water. I think you've, again, set the predicate here for what they have in mind. How does that look post-election? Let's just say, as seems arguably likely, Donald Trump, despite all of these efforts to delegitimize or otherwise contest the outcome of the election on the 3rd of November, may well be the winner that night, apparently even of a electoral college victory. But there will be a delay of game. There will be contesting, as I say, of returns, Pennsylvania being just one of the states, probably not sending delegates to an electoral college in time. What happens in the middle of all of this, Rich, and what does the run-up to the inauguration look like as your crystal ball projects?
Well, I think there are various potential courses of action. I think, as kind of a campaign planning, strategic planning guy, I think the things I'm most concerned about are the most dangerous courses of action. And the most dangerous course of action that I see is a continued escalatory, violent line of effort, which we've seen over the past year as, went from some riots and beating some people up wearing MAGA stuff. And then it turned into, now we're going to burn down a building. And then it turned into we're going to destroy some Trump wear, some Trump supporters are going to get beat up. Then it turned into all of a sudden, large scale rioting in the streets. Then it turned into burning down buildings. And then, we've seen in the past month or so, the targeted killing of police officers, the targeted killing of MAGA supporters. And, if you go back and you look at the Portland incident, that was a trained hit team. That was not a lone gunman shooting somebody. That was a trained hit team with information operations. The Antifa is a terrorist organization. Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization. And so what I'm concerned about is that these organizations could be let loose in a post-election kind of chaotic environment to target perhaps specific public figures, because the terrorism is about communication. What they want to show is that they're in control, they're really upset, they will escalate the violence unless people continue to support the removal of a newly elected President Trump. And then somebody asked me, well, what else could it be? It could be something as simple as another Chaz type thing, but instead of showing up in just Seattle, we have they take and they hold ground in 50 cities, right? We don't know what's possible. One thing is for sure, we can't just sit and act like nothing's going to happen.
So what do you recommend we do, Rich?
I think the president needs to direct the Defense Department, the FBI, the national security organs to have a contingency plan in place. I think that he needs to speak forcefully about the nature of the color revolution. One of the great weaknesses of the color revolution is that they don't work well when you expose them. If people are aware of what the media is doing, if people are aware of how these international bodies are doing, then the American people, they're smart, they're analytical. They'll say, that's just them trying to turn us away again. So again, knowledge and forewarning will ameliorate some of the risk here, right? And I think then the most important thing, and I know you and I have talked about this in the past, Frank, is the president has to have a proclamation to disperse ready. They have to get the Section 230 thing done on the socials. They have to have the Insurrection Act ready to go after the proclamation to disperse. And finally, the president needs to sit down with his Republican colleagues, because the Republicans, their role in all this is to just sit by and let it happen, right? If they're going to fall in with the revolution, they just have to sit by and let it happen. And I'm really concerned that the Republicans may see this as an opportunity to kind of remove this MAGA agenda guy, not realizing that they're burning their own base to the ground in so doing.
Rich Higgins, I hope that you will be coming back to us very soon, and we'll continue this conversation at greater length. God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great work. God bless the rest of you, and come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.